Well, good evening, everybody. I've started the 11th step talk in a great way, rushing here. And I completely forgot that we kick off this at 7 o'clock instead of 7:30. I mean, I've been coming a long time and you'd think I would get it, but I didn't. And anyway, so I want to apologize for giving Nancy the heebie-jeebies about, will I be here? But here I am, and it's moment by moment. So just because of the way I came in doesn't mean to say it's the way I have to be. And I just want to say this, and when I was asked to speak here the last time, I gave a talk on Dana. And I know a lot of us in the program hear this talk of Dana and our eyes roll. And it's like, oh God, here comes that talk again. But it, like everything else, it is a practice. And before any meeting in the 12-step program, we read a preamble. And the Buddha, when he spoke, before he gave any discourse, he spoke on generosity. Because he said it was the fundamental foundation of the spiritual life is to be generous. And some of us are not born generous. I mean, some of us beat ourselves up because we can't keep our rooms tidy. And some of us are not born with the great organizational app. But we can practice and we can ask for help. And generosity is one of those things that we get to practice. And it doesn't come easy for a lot of us. But it is just one of the fundamental things. And it doesn't mean to say we beat ourselves up because we can't give. It's just the practice. And see what happens if I put a little extra money in the basket in a meeting. How does it make me feel? Does it make me feel generous? Does it make me feel deprived? Does it make me feel, what does it make me feel? So generous in all sorts of ways with our money and with our time. I know when it came time for me to do a ninth step with my mother, I employed this feeling of generosity, and I went home and I spent 3 weeks with her, sitting with her and talking with her, which was, I deemed it as a very generous act on my part. to not move, but so that's just what I wanted to say about that. Now, how long is this talk? Oh, all right. Well, how about 40 days and 40 nights? Is that all right? Yes. So, no, that's all right. So good. The I would like to say this. I'm actually at the moment watching The West Wing. I never saw it when it was on television, and so I've ordered it from Netflix, and I'm compulsively watching one episode after the other, and it's an interesting time to be watching it, and I'm finding it very fascinating. And I just watched an episode, and this story was told. I've never heard this story before, probably many of you have, so just bear with me, and maybe you can hear it again with a British accent. But Leo is telling this story to Joel, and he's saying, or is Josh, I think his name is Josh, that... there's an alcoholic and he walks down the road and he falls into a deep hole. And some religious men come by, a rabbi, an imam, a priest, whatever. And the alcoholic yells out and says, "Help me." And the priest, the rabbi, the imam, they write out a prayer and they shoot it down the hole to him. And then a little while later, a doctor, a physician comes by and he shouts out, "Help me, help me." So the physician writes out a prescription and throws that down the hole and says, take these 3 times a day or something like that. Then the next person to come along is an alcoholic. And he says, "Help me, help me." And the alcoholic jumps in the hole with him. And the guy down there says, "You fool, now we're both in the hole." And the other guy says, "Yes, but I've been here before and I know the way out." Mm. And I think that really struck me, you know, that we in the program will, we have a saying, you know, I am responsible. And I am responsible for, if you cry out for help, that I will go to you and help you to see how to get out of that situation. Throw the alcohol out of the house, read labels, you know, stay away from people, places, and things, all the basic things that we will tell people how to get out of the hole of crippling addiction, because we've been there and we know what it is like. And you and I, we own the words of everlasting life. We have the high kernel, the secret teachings of everlasting life. And those words are, I know how you feel. Let me tell you what happened to me. And we in Alcoholics Anonymous follow in a great tradition, is the wrong word, I can't always get the right word, of the great teachers that have come into the world to show us a way. And let's start with the Buddha. The Buddha didn't say, you should do this, that, and the other thing. He said, this is what I do, and don't believe, you don't have to believe me, but sit down and see for yourself. Look at your own mind. See if what I'm saying is the truth. And come and tell me about it. Come and report back. And Jesus said the same thing to his disciples and to people that were with him. You know, he didn't say, you have to do this, you have to do that, and da, 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 da. He said, come follow me. Just see what I'm up to and see if you like this way of life. And he didn't insist on people doing it his way. One of the stories in the Bible, I think, is, I'm not, it's stories in the Bible, I think, is so fabulous for the alcoholic, especially those of us that have sponsees. And there's the story where the young man, who was quite well-to-do, went to him and he said, you know, Lord, what do I have to do to gain eternal life? And Jesus said, we've got to do this, that, and the other thing. And he said, well, I've done all those things. So Jesus said, well, there is one more thing. You have to sell all that you have and come and follow me. And in our terms, that means, you know, let go of all your old ideas, let go absolutely, and follow this program. And the young man shrugged and he walked off. He decided he couldn't do it. And in the story, it does not say, and Jesus ran after him saying, well, all right. The kingdom of heaven for you, we got a deal on it today. You don't have to do all those things because you're special. And how many of us come into the program and say, yes, but, I, and my situation. You know, you didn't stand at the door when I walked into AA and said, oh, you're an auctioneer. Oh, you're in the art world. Oh, you're this, that, and the other thing. Well, for you, since you're so unusual, you and the pressures on you and the kind of job you have, it's all right for you to have a little wine at lunch. You didn't give me anything. You just said, this is what we do. This is how we do it. And if you want, I'm stripping. This isn't a strip meditation, I can assure you. It's just, I'm not taking anything else off. You know, this is what we do. And if you want what we've got, this is what we do. And really, the highest form of love and 12-step work is once we've told our stories and the other person is saying, yes, but, it's for us to go, this is what I do. This is, I can't tell you, this is, you know, I can't adjust it for you. And my job, because I have this gift, is to give it undiluted, to share my experience, strength, and hope with each other, with another alcoholic, without a flavor on it, without taking into account, oh, you're a special case. You're a scientist, huh? Or you never graduated from high school. You've done time in prison, or you're the dean of a university. My job, I've been charged with passing on the message and not looking at the particular circumstances of who is receiving that message and not adjusting it at all. And I know there's a tendency to, if we go into a really low bottom situation, to sort of get down and dirty with that low bottom situation so they can see that we really know the street, and we really know. I always remember, you know, there was one time, I'm sober 36 years, so it goes back a long way. There was one time when I was working in the auction business, and I went I was asked to speak at a woman's prison. And I was really caught up with myself. I had to go on this cruise and give a talk on the cruise. And, you know, if you go on a cruise, there's loads of alcohol flowing. And I wasn't that long sober. I was in my first 5 years. And I arrive, I'd come straight from work, and I arrived in a full-length mink coat. I mean, I would never wear mink today, but I mean, in those days, you know, I wasn't so... But anyway, I was wearing this mink coat, so they must have thought, you know, Lady Duwa Diddy is walking into the... But I thought, you know, who am I kidding? Am I going to talk about, you know, some bottle fight on Avenue D? I'm not. It's not my experience. I didn't do that, so... I told my story straight. I told my story exactly as it was for me, not that they were, you know, had a far more deprived upbringing than I had. And I shared with them that I was going on this cruise and that I was very nervous about it. And they, their opportunity of ever going on a cruise like I was going on was very minimal. And yet they responded with help and suggestions, and it was terrific. So the, you know, I'm called on to be very truthful about my experience. And I think, I don't know where that is, but I know that's one of the, cardinal rules that the Buddha had for his monks, that to never adjust their experience, to be very truthful about their experience, to not say that they had this glorious insight when they actually did not. So, I want to talk about the 11th step, and I want to start it off by saying, I don't know if any of you have ever read this book, probably many of you have. It's by Kevin Griffin, and it's called One Breath at a Time, and it's Buddhism and the 12 Steps. It's really a wonderful book, I think. It really marries the two together. So I'd like to read what he says about it. So step 11, as we all know, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. So his, her, it, whatever. And so he says here, step 11 leads us directly into the fullness of spiritual life. It shows a direct line between our spiritual practices and our connection with ultimate truth. Once we've weathered the storms of inventory and amends, this step leads us to a safe harbor where we can begin to live the promises of peace and serenity. While step 10 helps us maintain our sobriety through inventory, step 11 may be even more important in our spiritual maintenance. And he goes on to say, many, it's under the heading the seeker, many addicts and alcoholics share this trait of seeking. Once we redirect our energy away from seeking oblivion and toward improving our lives, this quality can be put to good use. The thirst for spirits, alcohol, can be turned towards reaching a higher spirit. When we come to this step and need to find a way to practice meditation, many people want to explore Buddhism. What's appealing about Buddhism is the fact that while most religions are orthodoxies, that is, they adhere to a system of ideas, of rules, of words, Buddhism is an orthopraxy. It adheres to a set of practices through which one can come to one's own understanding, not one imposed from the outside. Indeed, this practical aspect of Buddhism is one of its main corollaries to the steps. 12-step programs don't care how you believe in a higher power or what you believe in. There's no requirement that you practice a certain form of meditation. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop our destructive behavior. The 12 steps are interested in results, just as the Buddha was interested in enlightenment. He overturned much of the orthodoxy of his day, not out of rebelliousness, but simply because he found it didn't work. The same is true of the 12 steps. Bill Wilson didn't put meditation and higher power and inventory and powerlessness in the steps because he thought they would be good ideas, or even because he was particularly devoted to God or these other principles, but because he found that he and others could stay sober using these guidelines. In the same way as the 12th step literature says, meditation is an intensely practical tool. In the 60s, when I first heard about meditation and things like enlightenment and cosmic consciousness, I imagined meditation as some otherworldly experience, something that would carry me up and away from my mundane existence. Now I see it first and foremost as a way to support and heal my mundane existence, a tool for developing calm acceptance, self-inquiry, and examination. And while sometimes I have experiences of great joy and bliss in meditation, that is more of a sideshow. The real meat, or tofu, if you prefer, is the way that meditation helps me connect with my own inner wisdom and thus engage more fully with my life. And I think that is really, you know, really, he's said it extremely well, that, you know, it doesn't matter what form of a high, well, we all know that. If we're in the program more than 5 minutes, we know that it doesn't matter what one chooses as one's higher power, as one has a higher power, and it doesn't matter kind of what one practices as long as one is practicing. And, you know, the orthodoxies and why so many people in the program are driven to, are enticed or attracted to Buddhist practice is because it's not so orthodox. It's not, you know, you should observe the Sabbath or go to Mass on Sundays or observe Fridays if you're a Muslim. It's not that way at all. And we all know that many of our meetings are held in traditional religious centers, and it's almost like the meat is going on in the basement and not much is happening up there. And I'm certainly not one to knock religion at all. I'm raised Catholic, and I'm very glad I was raised Catholic. I had a great awakening. I've shared this many, many times, but in my early days, in the early 80s, I went off to India to see the work of Mother Teresa. I didn't think I'd ever get to meet her, but I wanted to see her work. Because Jesus said, if you don't believe me for the work's sake. And is that not what we say? We say, well, look, if you don't believe what I'm saying to you, look at all these people in the rooms that are sober 5 years, 15 years, 25 years, 30 years. I mean, you don't have to believe, but this is the work. This is what these steps have produced. And so I wanted to see what that kind of unconditional love looked like. You know, I don't think I have unconditional love. I don't think I've been the beneficiary of it, but in examining myself, I don't think I have it. I think the only people that really have it are parents. And, I've just broken my necklace, that's good. And so I wanted to see, but anyway, in my first encounter with Mother Teresa, she asked me, we subsequently became quite close, she asked me, are you Catholic? And I said, well, I was born Catholic. But I don't know how I feel about the virgin birth. I don't understand devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, and I really don't like the Pope. And she said, oh, you're Catholic. So it was like dismissed. It was like, you know, stop making excuses. You don't have to do anything. You can use it as a stepping stone. I think what are the downfall of most traditional religions is they hold one down instead of inviting one to explore. You've got to stay with this orthodoxy. And, you know, when I examined it, for myself, this is only my observation, I think the Jews have their great prayers. The Episcopalians have their great hymns, and the Catholics have their mystery. I mean, how many times did I ask Sister Dua, did he, you know, why is that? Why is that? What do you mean, the Holy Spirit or the Holy Ghost or whatever? And she'd say, it's a mystery. And, you know, we never understood, but I would go into chapel at the school I went to, and there'd be the statues and the stations of the cross and the incense. And it was also mystical. And it gave me that sense of mystery. So I, you know, there's a lot about it I didn't like, I don't like, I don't go along with. But I'm grateful that I had that foundation. And I'm grateful that I had the foundation of seeing a mystical, for me, that's what it was. And it helped me not to ask so many questions, to just accept, you know, how many... I remember in the beginning my sponsor asking me if I had alcohol in the house. And I said, yes, I do. And she said, well, I suggest you get rid of it. So I said, just a second. You know, I have some very fine wine in the house. Meanwhile, I was living by myself and all that. And she said, get rid of it. So I said, Ellen, if I suddenly found out I was allergic to diamonds, would you tell me to get rid of my diamonds? And she said, listen to you equating diamonds with alcohol. Get rid of it. So, you know, I didn't understand the ramifications of that. I just didn't understand. I thought when I came into AA that AA was all about learning to resist alcohol, that I was supposed to learn how to say, No, it doesn't bother me if you drink. You go ahead. I'm fine. Terrific. That I was to develop this being cool around alcohol, you know, that I could go into bars, that I could... When I was 32 years sober, I was at an Epicurean dinner in Kentucky, and I almost drank. So, you know, and on examination, I had to think, you know, if I would never have gone to an Epicurean dinner in my first 9 months, in my first 90 days of sobriety, what was I doing at this dinner in my 33rd year? So it was, you know, when my sponsor told me to get the alcohol out of my house, I couldn't see any relationship between getting the alcohol out of my house and this path I was going on. I couldn't see it because I had no, like, deep bell-clanging reality about my drinking. I was one of those I had to come to about my drinking. I had to realize, oh, my God, maybe that was passing out at the dinner table. Maybe that wasn't just being tired and going to sleep. And my story was very slowly revealed to me. I did not come into the program with, I'm an alcoholic, I need help. I came into the program with, well, I didn't come into the program, actually. I was brought into the program by powers in the universe. I don't know. I ended up in the program, and it took me 2 years of constant meetings to understand that I had riddled with alcoholism. I thought I'd nipped it in the bud. I thought I had tendencies, but I didn't really have it. And now I realize I was a very bad case of alcoholism. And, I mean, you could see me coming a mile away. You knew I was in a lot of trouble. But it didn't feel that way to me. And so when I was told to do things by you, I couldn't see the rhyme or reason to do it, what the connection was. But I followed your instructions, maybe mostly because I didn't want you to ignore me, and I didn't want you to kick me out, and I didn't want to be thrown out of AA. The one thing I knew about myself was that my life was shabby. I knew it was icky. I had a very female story. It was all like, oh, God, I didn't do that, did I? I didn't wear that, did I? I didn't say that, did I? It was that kind of a thing. So, you know, this sense of mystery. So I got, when I was, how long was I sober? I was quite a way along, maybe 7 years, 8 years sober. And I was invited to a retreat, a weekend retreat at IMS, at Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, out of which New York Insight is inspired and is born out of that. And it was on that weekend retreat that I came into contact with Vipassana meditation, which is the main meditation taught here. And I realized that that's what I wanted to practice, and it made such sense to me. It was like no frills meditation. You know, there was music playing or anything like that, no humming. There was, it was just straightforward meditation and a practice of staying in my life in this moment. And if you're an alcoholic of my sort, you've missed a lot of your life. You've missed a lot of life. And most people do. Most people, even if they're not alcoholics, miss a lot of their lives. But I have a thirst not to miss any more of my life. And so I must practice watching my life. I must practice. It doesn't come. I can say, all right, I don't want to miss any more of my life. I want to practice being here in the now. But, you know, how many of us drive a car or get on a bus or whatever we do in New York, and we're totally unaware of our hands holding things, of our feet walking, of, as we are right here sitting now, and our hands in our laps. And this is how I practice staying in this moment. And for me, and for you, it's very important that we practice this thing of being right here, right now. And one of the things in our modern society that pulls us away from this and we can all identify, I'm sure I'm not the only one, is the cell phone. You know, how many times am I on the cell phone and someone is in front of me? Like the girl checking out my groceries in the supermarket. She's not important. I can't pay attention to her. But I'm on the cell phone and I'm talking because this is so important. And I try to catch myself over and over. I leave it alone. I try not to take it everywhere. I try to use it as a tool for what it was meant for. And because I have been mortified by the rudeness I have done by being on the cell phone and not with this person. And it's particularly poignant for me because in the last year of my drinking, I was in England and, you know, I was involved in a disastrous love affair. Most of us women come in on an emotional horror. And my father was standing at the garden gate waving goodbye to me. And I was so caught up with my life, my tragic life, you know, nothing's going right. I was 30 years old. And my father was waving goodbye to me. And I just couldn't be bothered, like, yeah, yeah, bye. And it was the last time I saw him. He died very suddenly. And I'm always filled with the great regret that I didn't pay attention to my father. And it hasn't caused me to be madly attentive to all I meet and say goodbye to from that moment on, but it does inform me and it does prick me a lot that I don't want to do that. I don't want to miss the conversation. You know, I'm very fascinated with the life of Christ, and that fascination brought me to Buddhism. I'm sure Jesus was a Buddhist. But I often think of, you know, they say that the saddest sentence in the Bible is, and Jesus passed by. And I'm sure if I'd been in Jerusalem in his time and with friends, they would have said, oh, Lorna, you should have been here 3 minutes ago. Jesus just passed by. You know, I would have missed my opportunity. So meditation for me is an opportunity to not miss my experience. And it's an awesome practice of seeing the times I can change my mind. You know, I knew my husband was wrong for me on the second date. He was late and he borrowed $5. And it was wrong. The relationship was wrong. There were many signs that it was wrong. But I went barreling through the stop signs, the bells, the whistles, the you waving the flags, don't go this way, don't go this way. Barreling through, sheep scattering, everything scattering. It was like, I was determined. And 13 years later, I'm in divorce court with this little piece of paper wondering what the hell happened. And devastated. And, you know, in our program, they tell us that picking up a drink is the end of the slip. There are many, many, many signs along the way. Don't go here. Don't say that. Whatever. It might not even be as dramatic as a slip. It might be, you know, telling someone what I really think of you, you know. How many opportunities I have to hold back, to examine that, to tenth step it, to just examine it, to sixth and seventh step it, to just before it. So it's also a great tool for us to, you know, I can be in a bar. I don't go into bars. I don't meet people in bars or anything like that. But, I mean, supposing I'm in a bar and I'm sitting on the bar stool and I've ordered a drink and I've got my hand around the drink and I've got it up to my lips, I can change my mind at any moment and reverse the situation. And that's why it's important that I pay attention to what I do, that what I do, that I can change my mind at any moment. I always tell sponsees, if you want to get a tattoo, if you insist on getting a tattoo, have I've changed my mind tattooed somewhere on yourself. You know, it's the most important thing for us to do, especially for young girls and young men too, that we don't get caught up in, you know, I didn't know how to have coffee with you without giving you the keys to my apartment. I didn't know, you know, I was driven. Once I set on a path, I was driven down that path. And meditation gives me that. Sit back and watch. And I can't tell you, it's helped me countless times. The thing that's caused me in my life the most pain, the most tears, the most regret is impatience. And, you know, and the impatience, I've had many practices now with pulling back from that and taking a breath and not acting out right now. And you know, everyone else besides me is very irritating. They can be very irritating at times. And to be in a meeting and hear old Harry speaking up again, you know, or to hear, and I'm sure people think the same about me, oh my God, there she goes again, taking the same old thing. But, you know, I give this example. A little while ago, I was in the post office and I was at the counter, you know, where you hand in your pink slip to pick up a package or something like that. And in front of me, the woman in front of me at the counter was a much older lady on a cane, and she had a woman helping her. And the postal worker, the lady helping her, was very kind and very patient and was explaining the same thing over and over again to this older woman. And I was getting, God, she's already told her three times about it. And I wanted to say, look, she's not getting it. You've already told her three times, and she's obviously not getting it. But something made me keep my feet on the floor, find out where I was, what was the heat of this surge of irritation arising in my body? Why did it need, it didn't need to come out? And then I heard the postal lady say to her, oh, you're very welcome, and I... let me offer you my condolences. I'm so sorry for your loss. Thank God I hadn't spoken out. You know, thank God I hadn't spoken out in irritation and anger. And sometimes we're able to see the karmic results of what we do and what we don't do. You know, I often describe my alcoholism as being in the train, and the train stops and I get out and I can see that I was actually in a carriage. And then I can, if I step away, I can see that it had an engine and a caboose to this train. I can see where, and then if I step back even further, I can see where it came from and where it was headed. But I don't have to go to where it was headed. But I can see where it's come from. And I can see the patterns, the same landscape that I went through over and over and over again, and I don't have to do it. I don't have to keep on that course. I don't know how long I've spoken, but it seems like it's a fairly long time. So I, just to hit on prayer for a while, you know, I think once, it's my experience and the experience of most people that are meditators, that the greatest prayer is silence. You know, and one of the reasons I love Vipassana is the silence. I used to be able to go away for 3 and 4 months at a time in a year, and but I haven't, because of health and things, I haven't been able to do that in recent years, but I try and put at least a month of silence in my life a year. And it's best for me if I can do it in a continuing lump. And so I, why am I saying that? Oh, my prayer, that's right, prayer. So when I feel the need for a prayer, you know, the tendency is to ask for something. To ask a power greater than myself for something. And it's usually sort of on a physical plane, you know. And I often say, you know, I'm deeply shallow, so I'll ask to lose 10 pounds or I'll ask something along those lines. And I'm never asking for peace for the world or anything. So for me, my greatest prayer is the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I want to be open to the world and I want to offer something for the world that's in my tradition, my heritage, I offer, you know, other traditions might offer the, I know we say the Our Father and the Serenity Prayer in New York. I mean, they never end a meeting with the preamble. We usually start with the preamble. But I just think it's one of the greatest pieces of literature in America. I think it should be up there with the Gettysburg Address and the I Have a Dream speech. I think it is phenomenal, the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's an interesting thing to dissect it, to take it apart, really reflect on each segment, you know. It tells me, it informs me of who I am, who I belong to, how this thing I belong to, this fellowship I belong to, it exists and comes into existence and is supported, and that the fact that there's no affiliation with anything else, and that it tells me what the requirement is for being a member here, and it also instructs me what my primary purpose is in life. And when I'm thinking that I'm hopeless and a mess and I've messed up and all that sort of thing, it galvanizes me into, I have a primary purpose. This is my primary purpose. And so I want to, I just want to end in the traditional way with, and then I'm going to open it up for questions, and then maybe if we have time, we'll break up into groups. But I want to end in the traditional way and thank you so much for going to meetings. Thank you for your service. Thank you for your devotion to your practice, because whether you think you've got a practice or not, you're sitting here in this room tonight, so you have a practice. And I want to thank you for your love for our fellowship, whatever 12-step program you might be in, and to thank you for your path, because if you weren't following the path, I'd have absolutely no one to follow. So thank you for your sobriety. Thank you.